This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, professor of television studies at Rowan University in New Jersey, in for Terry Gross. Today, we feature interviews with two people nominated for Oscars for their work on the Jane Campion film, The Power of the Dog, composer Johnny Greenwood and actor Benedict Cumberbatch. The film is nominated for 12 Oscars in total. First, we'll listen to Terry's interview from last month with Johnny Greenwood. He was known as the lead guitarist and keyboard player for the rock band Radiohead when screenwriter and director Paul Thomas Anderson asked him to write the score for his film There Will Be Blood. That score was described in Rolling Stone as a sonic explosion that reinvented what film music could be. Greenwood wrote the scores for Anderson's subsequent films, including Phantom Thread and The Master, which opened like this. Greenwood also writes a lot of film music that is more avant-garde, but some of the avant-garde music is influenced by his love of Baroque. He studied classical music when he was young, played in a youth orchestra, and has been a composer in residence at the BBC Concert Orchestra. You can hear his music in three very different recent movies. Paul Thomas Anderson's newest film, Licorice Pizza, which is set in the 70s, Spencer, starring Kristen Stewart as Princess Diana, and The Power of the Dog, which is set in Montana in 1925. In the beginning of The Power of the Dog, two brothers who own a large cattle ranch are herding the cattle to market. This is the music we hear.
Johnny Greenwood, welcome to Fresh Air. I love your music. It's a pleasure to have you on our show. So that music that we just heard from The Power of the Dog, it starts like it's going to be very Western-ish, but not quite. And then there's other potentially menacing music intruding on it. It's a buzzy, ominous-sounding melody interfering with this Western-ish kind of sound. So, and it lets you know that this isn't going to be a conventional Western, even though they're herding cattle. And it also lets you know that bad things are going to be interfering. What's happening musically? What are you doing musically?
I think Westerns have a traditional sound, which is big sweeping strings and sort of Copland-style harmonies, which are not only beyond me, but wouldn't have really suited the darkness of the film, I think. So the approach to this was originally to try and write music for banjo and string quartet, because I'm a big believer that the banjo can be a great, dark, sinister instrument. I mean, I grew up listening to things like the Violent Femmes, and they managed to do that sort of country death song style, you know, banjo as you know, the opposite of the Steve Martin, you know, right. routine about how banjos just make you smile, which is true, and you know, and all that stuff is wonderful music, but there's also a dark side, I think, to that kind of music. Anyway, I persuaded her to let me try and write something for banjo and string quartet, and it was awful, as you might imagine, and just sounded wrong in every way. So on the rebound from that, I just started trying to play my cello like it was a banjo, so doing the rolling finger picking thing on a cello instead.
So with the strings that kind of interfere with that plucked cello sound, making the sound even more unconventional, what did you do to get that kind of menacing sound from violins or violins and violas?
So I had them play with no vibrato, and you know, that's a really beautiful effect in a way. I think the danger with writing music not on paper and relying on computers and demos is that you start to get used to how some string sounds and then just look to replicate that. Whereas the variety of colour that, you know, one player can make with a string instrument is already kind of, it's quite mind-blowing. And just the combination of a whole ensemble and all the directions it can go, it's really exciting and daunting. And it's like, it's easily my favourite day of the year is when the string players turn up for an afternoon.
Do you want the strings to be perfectly tuned, or do you want them to be just slightly off?
Okay. Yes. I wrote one cue for the Lynn Ramsey film, You're Never Really Here. We're asking them to have half the players tuned a quarter tone flat, so just a little bit out of tune, but all as out of tune as one another, if you see what I mean. But because they're playing with their ears, it's very hard to do. So they're still making their fingers go to where their ear wants to hear the right note. So even though it was difficult to do and they were sort of weren't doing it properly, it was one of those things where you just end up being even more impressed by what they can do and how they're playing and thinking and making these sounds.
One of your influences who you've also worked with is Krzysztof Penderecki, an avant-garde composer, who once said that we have to use instruments which were built 300 years ago or 200. And the newest instrument in the orchestra is the saxophone, but that's at least 100 years old. And he said, in the century of landing on the moon, he said this during the 20th century, we still have to write for very old instruments, museum instruments. I think this is the problem. It became the problem in the second half of the 20th century that there's not much progress because of the lack of instruments, of new instruments. And I thought of you when I read that, and this is quoted on an album that you collaborated with him in on. I thought of you because it seems to me you want to make old instruments sound new by messing them up a little bit, by doing unusual things with them or having them do unusual things with each other, whether it's their tunings or their dissonances, the number of instruments you use. So do you relate to that quote about using old instruments for new music?
I do, because I've always found acoustic instruments, certainly orchestral instruments, to be capable of much more variety and strangeness and complexity than, you know, nearly all of the software I've used in the past. And I think that's maybe why, to me, music by people like Penderecki and Ligeti and it just still sound very strange and contemporary, and they still sound like the music of the future to me, whereas lots of the electronic stuff that was done in the 60s and 70s, you hear it now and it's sort of its time.
Oh, that's so true. That is really true.
And I think that all instruments are just technology, however old or new they are. And the ideal situation is where you can just regard them as being all on the same level of importance and interest, and whether it's a, you know, a piano or a laptop or an electric guitar or a tuba, they're all hugely exciting things, you know. And you know, I remember as a 10-year-old, whatever, whenever my mum was driving us around, if we went past a music shop, my daydream as we drove past was never imagine being able to go in and buy a guitar or whatever. It would be imagine being able to go and buy a flute or a trumpet. I was just fascinated with all these different colours and ways of making music and making sounds. And in a really tragic middle-aged man kind of way, that's sort of what I've turned my life into, as I'm sitting talking to you, surrounded by lots of, you know, those kind of instruments.
But I'm wondering, getting back to that Penderecki quote, I'm wondering if you tried to make old instruments sound just a little bit unrecognizable and use them in a way that sounds new, even though the instrument is old. You know, that sounds like a new sound that you're getting from it.
So I was very lucky when I was in elementary school, age 9, 10, that we were sitting with our teacher and he had everyone bring in their instruments, whether it was recorders or violins. And he said, okay, everyone try and make a new sound with your instrument. Try and get a different noise out of it. And that really stuck with me. That was just something that fascinated me then and is probably, you know, still in my how I work today. So yeah, just very grateful to have, you know, great music teacher at an early stage of my life.
Do you remember what you did to get a different sound?
I think I put the bow under the strings and played the bottom string and top string at the same time, as I remember. But just realizing that there were really no rules, and if it makes a sound, then it's musical, and you can just look at an instrument and think about it in any way you want to.
I want to talk with you about the music for Phantom Thread. There's three versions of what's basically like the theme of the movie, and I want to play two of those versions. And we're going to start with version two. And I should say, at this point, the movie is about this very kind of classical fashion designer who is both obsessive and very set in his ways and very temperamental. And he deals, you know, he does like gowns and other evening dresses for, you know, high society, wealthy women. And so when we hear this music, his muse-girlfriend is about to start poisoning him with mushrooms, because when he isn't feeling well, when he's vulnerable, he becomes more accessible and more affectionate and needy. And that puts her in a better position, she thinks. So this is a duet with you at the piano and Daniel Piorro on violin. I think that is really just a beautiful theme, just everything is like just a little bit off. I'm wondering if the piano that you're playing there is prepared in any way, because the notes sound imperfectly tuned and a little bit muffled maybe. So what have you done with the piano?
There's a roll of felt laid between the hammers and the strings, which is why it sounds like that. And it's a little bit out of tune just because I'm a bit lazy with my booking the piano tuner, I'm afraid. But that one.
It's not because you like the sound, it's because you're lazy?
it's because I like the sound, yes. And I'm lazy.
So you have felt under the lid, like on the strings, as opposed to like on the keys. They're on the felt is on the strings.
Yes.
And the violin, it's almost like you asked him, I want to hear the friction of the bow on the strings.
Well, Daniel is a very physical player indeed, and is interested in every possible color and texture. And I also love a recording where you can hear the physicality of what's happening, whether it's the breathing of the player or the effort involved in making the music, you know. And I know it drives some people crazy, but things like Glenn Gould singing along and all of that reminder that there's all this muscle and physical effort behind the making of the music, I just makes it, you know, more exciting to me. I think that stuff is quite often clinically stripped out in most people's consumption of music, and especially classical music.
So let's hear another version of the theme that we heard from Phantom Thread. And this happens as the fashion designer is really feeling the effects of the poison. And so he's been talking to his sister, and he's been complaining about his muse, and he doesn't realize he's being poisoned by her. But he says, "There's an air of quiet death in this house, and I do not like the way it smells." So here we go. This is a more orchestral version and a more dirge-like version of the theme that we heard. This is from The Phantom Thread, music composed by my guest, Johnny Greenwood. I just love that. And I'm not sure exactly what to ask you, but can you talk a little bit about shaping it into that version of the theme?
Sure. I mean, I'm a big fan of these historically very inaccurate recordings of Baroque music that were done in the 70s, 60s, 70s, 80s, even before the authenticity police stepped in and made everyone play with the right size of orchestra and the right kind of violins. And because it's sort of glorious hearing this Baroque music done with big romantic orchestras, for all that it's, you know, would never have sounded like that. So that was a reference I sent to Paul. And he was also talking about that Kubrick film, Barry Lyndon, that has some big Baroque orchestral things in it. And it was just, you know, I mean, on my level, another excuse to get in a room with an orchestra and just revel in that beautiful big sound they make.
So before you were with Radiohead, my understanding is you were in a band with Tom York's younger brother. Tom York is the lead singer, songwriter from Radiohead. So your older brother was in a band with Tom York. You were in a band with Tom York's younger brother. Do I have that right?
You do, that's right.
So how did you end up playing with Tom York and forming Radiohead?
Well, they had a keyboard player who, it's Tom's band, had a keyboard player, which I think they didn't get on with because he played his keyboard so loud. And so when I got the chance to play with them, the first thing I did was make sure my keyboard was turned off when I was playing. And I must have done months of rehearsals with them with this keyboard that was just, they didn't know that I'd already turned it off and was just, they made quite a racket, quite a noise. It was all guitars and distortion. And so I would pretend to play for weeks on end. And Tom would say, I can't quite hit what you're doing, but I think you're adding a really interesting texture that, because I can tell when you're not playing. And I'm thinking, no, you can't, because I'm really not playing. And I'd go home in the evening and work out how to actually play chords and cautiously over the next few months, I would start turning this keyboard up. And that's how I started, started in with Radiohead.
Wait a minute, I want to make sure I understand this correctly. So the first period that you were playing with Radiohead, you turned off the keyboard.
Yeah.
And so you were sure. Fingering the keys, but no sound was being emitted because this is an electric keyboard. So
exactly.
Nothing was coming out and nobody noticed.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we were kind of noisy garage band, I suppose, in a small rehearsal room. And I remember the first few songs when I did start playing melodies and Tom liked it and it was very exciting.
So since you've had a foot in classical music and in rock for so long and have been important in both worlds, I think the division has melted away for a lot of classical performers, but not so much for other people because so many people don't listen to classical music at all anymore. It's just not, I think it's become more and more of a niche. With the exception of film scores. This is one of the great things about film scores, is that it brings a different kind of music often into people who otherwise wouldn't hear it.
I think streaming has been quite bad for classical music, because if you are keen to find out more about classical music, you might have heard that the Beethoven Violin Concerto is a great piece of music. So you go on to Spotify or whatever, and when you search for it, you're presented with 500 recordings. And I think it's just a bit of a sort of daunting and off-putting thing. There's very little curation. I do sort of mourn the days when you used to listen to a record hundreds of times and get everything you could out of it. And I'm the same. I'll listen to a Miles Davis record on Spotify, and then rather than play it again, I'll move on to the next one. And there's just none of that sort of obsession. And I think classical music especially suffers with that, because if you can, you know, live with the same piece of classical music for a few weeks, you know, it'll reveal itself to you. But it's about having the patience to do that.
I know you like performing in churches and listening to music in churches, because often the period of music that's being played is from the period that the church was built in. Correct me if I'm wrong here. But can you talk a little bit about that, about the experience of being like in an old church or cathedral and playing or hearing music there?
Yeah, so I'm spending a lot of time in Italy at the moment, and the churches there have just some glorious and strange organs that I've been really lucky enough to play and write a few things for. That's opened up a whole side of classical music I didn't know about, like all these early organs that have two sets of black keys so that you can play the notes in between the notes, a bit like Penderecki, I suppose. And it have keys that reproduce the sound of birds singing. And if you look inside the organ, it's these little boxes with water in that blow air through them. And these instruments are, you know, 400 or 500 years old. And it just occurs to me that when you're sitting hearing one being played, you are hearing an actual authentic performance from that would be identical to someone sitting in the same chair 500 years earlier, because the walls are the same and the pipes are the same and the organ is the same, and this is what it sounded like. And there's a sort of exciting time travelery sort of enjoyment to be had with that kind of music, I think.
Johnny Greenwood, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you for your music. And I'm expecting one or more of your scores to be nominated for Oscars. So, you know, I don't know if you care very much about awards, but I wish you good luck in award season.
Thank you. Thank you, Terry.
Johnny Greenwood speaking to Terry Gross last month. He's nominated for an Academy Award this year for his score for the film The Power of the Dog. After a break, we'll hear from another Oscar nominee from that same movie, lead actor nominee Benedict Cumberbatch. This is Fresh Air.